Good morning. Hello. My name is Rosie Goldstein. I'm the Vice Principal, Research and International Relations here at McGill University. It is my privilege today to introduce our annual Beattie Memorial Lecture. This lecture is named for Sir Edward Beattie, who was the Chancellor and Chair of the Board of Governors of McGill University from 1920 to 1943. The goal of this lecture is to bring to McGill University top scholars, scientists, and individuals of international stature to the university. I think you will agree that today's lecture fits that requirement. It's my great honor and privilege to welcome our distinguished guest and newest alumnus, Dr. Alfred Brendel, to give this lecture. I invite him back to the stage to give his highly anticipated lecture, "Does Classical Music Have to Be Entirely Serious?" Please join me again in welcoming Dr. Brendel to the stage.
Good morning, good afternoon, what is it? No, good morning. First, I would like to ask the engineers a favor to turn down the air conditioning a little. It's quite drafty here on stage. I don't know whether they hear me, but let's try. Can you hear me, by the way? Yeah, can you hear me? So good. In his remarkable essay on Schubert of 1894, Antonín Dvořák makes it clear that he cannot consider Schubert's masses as ecclesiastical, even though he concedes that the feeling for what is truly sacred music may differ somewhat among nations and individuals, as does the sense of humor. I own a cartoon from the former Czechoslovakia. In it, a pianist is shown sitting on the stage of a concert hall. But instead of performing the piece on the music stand in front of him, he is helpless with laughter. The composition that provokes his amusement bears the title A Dvořák Humoresque. In the cartoon, the faces of the audience are all completely serious. They appear quite unmoved by the mirth of the pianist, who must surely have been the first to discover that Dvořák's Humoresque should be a matter for laughter. Of course, the audience of a pianist is not supposed to laugh, but neither is the pianist. For those who claim that music cannot be truly comical without the assistance of words or without relating to visible reality, humoresques from Schumann to Rachmaninoff and Reger provide ample proof. So, I'm afraid, does Mozart's A Musical Joke. It is a work in which, as far as I can see, a catalogue of musical blunders is distributed with little kindness, along with some blatantly wrong notes the performers are made to play on purpose. One of the reasons why Mozart did not succeed better in offering a more amusing satire of the incompetence of his colleagues may be found in the fact that this was his first musical attempt to seek distraction after the death of his father. Where then does one look for the comical in music outside the realm of opera and song? There are, of course, pieces with funny titles. Ouf le petit pois, prelude inoffensive, or étude asthmatique, show that Rossini, in those late compositions that are called sins of old age, refused to take himself as seriously as the romantic composers did. This man, who throughout his life suffered discomfort from several agonizing illnesses, kept up the appearance of a musical buffoon. His delightful non-operatic music, unusual in its time, casts no shadows. Some of Rossini's pieces make me laugh even without their titles, whereas nearly all of Erik Satie's melancholy miniatures are funny only on account of their titles. For me, the most convincingly comical absolute music has been written by the Viennese classics and by some 20th century composers. Giorgi Ligeti's Aventure and Nouvelles Aventures, even on records, should make almost anybody laugh, and much more so if you watch the singers and players produce all those lovely noises in the concert hall. The work qualifies as absolute music because it does not employ words, and it is not basically theatrical. It is reminiscent of human utterance, motion, and behavior, which to me remains one of the legitimate effects of music, even if in the past it used to be achieved in a far more stylized fashion. There is no shortage of evidence that at least some of Haydn's and Beethoven's contemporaries relished a musical sense of humor and admired it in the works of the two composers. A contemporary writer put his delight into these words: "Any pretense of seriousness only serves the purpose of making the playful wantonness of the music appear as unexpected as possible, and of teasing us from every side until we succumb and give up all attempts to predict what will happen next, to ask for what we wish for, or to demand what is reasonable." According to Georg August Griesinger, an early biographer of Haydn, a sort of innocent mischievousness, or what the British call humor, was a main trait of Haydn's character. He easily discovered what he preferred, the comical side of things. Haydn himself confessed to another biographer, Albert Christoph Diess, that there is a frame of mind in which, to quote Diess, "a certain kind of humor takes possession of you and cannot be restrained." He also thought this was a quality which stemmed from an abundance of good health. About Beethoven, Friedrich Rochlitz writes, "Once Beethoven is in the mood, rough, striking witticisms, odd notions, surprising and exciting juxtapositions and paradoxes occur to him in a steady flow." If we apply this statement to Beethoven's comic music, we have a valuable list of characteristics that bear musical scrutiny. Before I present some musical examples, I should like to draw attention to the fact that there is widespread confusion about the meaning of humor, irony, and wit. Not only does it differ from language to language, in the sense of Dvořák's remark, which I quoted at the beginning, it turns out to be a deeply personal matter, as indeed religion should be. In an aphorism by the German writer Jean Paul, he calls humor the sublime in reverse. I can therefore only submit a choice of pieces that I personally find funny, amusing, ludicrous, or hilarious, and I have settled for the word comic to signify an ingredient that is common to all of them. Whether oddities and incongruities of a purely musical nature will strike the listener as hilarious, strange, or disturbing must depend on the psychological climate of each piece, but also on the psychological disposition of each listener. Here's a little piece by Haydn. Thank you. I apologize for having misled you by leaving out essential portions of this piece. 4 bars of the first part and 30 of the second. Besides, I have ignored the written out repeats of both parts, which would make the piece twice as long. I shall now play the third movement of Haydn's late C major sonata as Haydn wrote it, but again without repeats. Comparing both versions, I would already call the shorter one a burlesque. The teasing avoidance of classical 4 or 8 bar patterns, the abortive storm in D minor that peters out almost before it begins, and its laughing and bouncing staccatos contribute toward making it comical. The complete version of the piece, however, is ludicrous to a much greater degree. By introducing the wrong B major chords within a C major piece as the most memorable surprise, it presents the listener with an intriguing problem. How should we understand these chords? How many explanations can we find for them? And which of these explanations prevails? The listener's initial impression of the first B major chord must be that of a faux pas. When we try to verify this impression, we get into trouble. How would a player of a C major piece who has stumbled into a B major chord by mistake behave? He could, like the late Sir Adrian Boult, turn to the audience, say, "Sorry, my fault," and start again. More probably, he or she would try to cover up the blunder. In this way, the offense of the B major chord would be rationalized. A mistake would be turned into an advantage, Schadenfreude into admiration for the player's quick reaction. The listener would, ironically speaking, laugh not at the player, but with him. The second best way out for the imaginary player would be to pretend that nothing had happened. Somebody slips on a banana skin and suddenly finds himself sitting on the ground. It will take him a few moments to pick himself up and proceed come prima with an innocent face. That is what Haydn seems to have done. A second hearing, however, may reveal that the wrong B major chord does not completely come out of the blue. The piece that had started and continues in purely diatonic writing brings in, as a little warning, a C sharp in the bar before. A C natural here
would sound downright harmless, as indeed it is supposed to sound 4 bars later when the same figure returns. Is then our B major chord a premeditated challenge that is not accepted? After all, Haydn could have stayed within the means of musical propriety and continued in the following fashion. We know more about the B major chord when it has reappeared in the recapitulation. It reasserts itself almost menacingly with the help of a ritardando after a short aggression into C minor has ended on the Neapolitan D flat. Else, the indicative retard underlines the fact that this is not simply a reproduction of the memory lapse or slip of the tongue that had occurred earlier. This is not just a mistake obstinately repeating itself. The proximity of the Neapolitan harmony makes the B major chord all the more provocative. Again, there is no apology afterwards. Neither is there any sign of unease. The piece continues in high spirits, laughing at us at the end. I am aware that there is some sort of harmonic resolution to the B major irritant 4 bars later. In the recapitulation, it is resolved into the dominant sevenths. As I feel it, these resolutions do not calm the psychological seas completely. They do not and should not remove the final suspicion that these B major chords are arbitrary and unjustified. An insult veiled by apparent innocence, an act of splendid nonsense that is all the more delightful because it cannot be explained away. As Schopenhauer said in his analysis of laughter, it is diverting to see the strict, untiring, troublesome governess the reason for once convicted of inadequacy. Summing up the comic traits in Haydn's piece, I find breaches of convention, the appearance of ambiguity, proceedings that masquerade as something they are not, for instance, as lacking professional knowledge or skill, veiled insults, and finally, nonsense. To become apparent, breaches of order need a framework of order. In other comical contexts, the framework is given by words and their meaning, by human situations and reactions, and by the kind of thought that is connected with language. In music, the framework relies on the established musical forms and expectations, and on the logic of purely musical thought. Such a framework is indeed available to the musical layman. The musical experience that is needed is comparable to the verbal experience a child needs to appreciate a joke. Of course, there are also sophisticated jokes for grown-ups. Why does classical music lend itself so readily to comic effect? Because it seems to me to reflect in its solid and self-sufficient forms and structures, the trust of the Enlightenment in irrational structures that rule the universe. The spirit of classical music seems to imply the belief that the world is good, or at least that it could become so. For the Romantics, there was no sense of order to rely upon. It had to be found or created in oneself. The open and fragmentary structures of romantic music, as epitomized by the fantasy, aim to be as personal and exceptional as possible. Where, as with Berlioz, surprise becomes the governing principle of composition, and music a succession of feverish dreams, comic effects have little chance. They have to be achieved as an assault on what is proper and predictable. Cadenzas of classical concertos were allowed and supposed to be unpredictable. The final trill, however, traditionally leading from the dominant seventh into the tonic and the orchestral tutti, was something that could be relied on for listeners and orchestral players alike. Beethoven, one of the supreme musical architects, wrote cadenzas that make Mozart look like models of restraint. In the marathon cadenza for his own C major concerto, the trill is the special target of his mockery. It never happens as it should. Ultimately, when the dominant seventh has been let loose in a frenzy of vehemently repeated scales, there is a last truly bizarre surprise. The two final chords are unnecessarily interrupted by a soft, short, arpeggiated one. I shall play the end of the cadenza first without this soft chord and lead directly into the orchestral tutti. Same thing with the interpolated chord. If this chord could speak an aside to the public or the orchestra, we might well understand something like, "Are we really coming to an end? Wouldn't you like the cadenza to be over? Heavens, didn't we forget the thrill?" As it didn't work before, why should it work now? Or simply, "Am I fooling you well?" Comic irreverence in classical music has a rational and an irrational significance. The rational side may be illuminated by a quote from Francis Hutcheson, a Scottish thinker of the Enlightenment. "Nothing is so properly applied to the false grandeur, either of good or of evil, as ridicule." And according to Schiller, the comic writer has continuously to amuse reason, shun pathos, and defend himself against passions. Comic music has no other use for the solemn, the rapturous, the pastoral, the heroic, or the frenzied than to make fun of it. On the other hand, irrationalism that had started to undermine the certainties of reason is musically manifest as a mockery of what is normal, worthy, and well-behaved. What rationalism does to grand emotions, irrationalism does to the civilized procedures of musical form. Diderot likened great artists in their defiance of rules to great criminals, and he conceded that the dark forces in man had their share in the creation of works of art. Nowhere have these dark forces surfaced more cheerfully than in several of Haydn's finales, or more disquietingly than in some of his works in minor keys. It needs to be said that formal peculiarities of a piece are not sufficient evidence for its comic qualities. Form and psychology have to interact. Two hallmarks of Haydn's eccentricity, his sudden rests and fermatas at unlikely places, and his extended repetitions of the same soft chord or note over several bars, can have a very different psychological impact on the listener in pieces of different character. To suspend, interrupt, or freeze the flow of music can be purely hilarious or purely disturbing. If it is both at once or oscillates between the two, the effect may be called grotesque. Ligeti's Aventure, Nouvelles Aventures, is grotesque music, and so is much of the comic music of the last century. Another obvious name in this context is that of the composer Maurizio Kagel. Generally, the same devices that make music amusing can also make it strange, eerie, disturbing, and macabre. The psychological climate of a piece will finally decide whether they are one or the other, or both. In classical music, they are likely to be one or the other. Incidentally, the colloquial use of the word funny takes care of both the comical and the strange. The basic key of a basically comic piece is a major key. There is, outside the field of opera or song, and I'm thinking of Osmin's aria from the Seraglio or Beethoven's Flow Lead, only one comical example in a minor key that comes to my mind, Beethoven's C minor Bagatelle from Opus 119. Is comical because a cheerful dance that should be in a major key is used to express grim resolution. Actually, there is another piece that I should mention. It appears within the context of a sonata of Beethoven's 110. Communication of comic resolution or comic anger is generally reserved for episodes in Beethoven's earlier rondo movements. This seems a good moment to introduce another area of comic music, that of the excessive and obsessive of overstatement and idée fixe. There is an as-if character about such music. It may resemble comic acting, caricature, and opera buffa. The composer seems to imply, this is not really me, I'm just turning into somebody choleric or absent-minded, into a pedant, a naughty child, or a very, very innocent child to amuse you. At the beginning of Beethoven's Variations Opus 35, there is a juxtaposition of excessive contrast, pianissimo and fortissimo. One may call it an alternation of whispering and stentorian laughter, or of tiptoeing and stamping. Other comic elements are in evidence. The bass alone, pretending to be the complete theme that in effect is only presented later. The rests before and after the fortissimo B flats, and the following B flat marked piano that appears to me like an actor putting a finger to his lips and going shh. In the course of these variations, Beethoven continues to play with the contrast of soft and loud, of changing and repeated notes. In variations 9 and 13, the loud B flats take over the whole variation as furious grunts or tear it apart as hysterical shrieks. Here are the furious grunts. Shrieking until the end of the variation. In variation 7, there is a series of grim belly laughs in the bass register, while the rest of the piece is provided with odd accents. Misplaced, witty, sarcastic, bizarre, obsessive accents are another tool of the composer in a comic frame of mind. The rondo of Beethoven's second piano concerto starts with accents against the grain. Later, before the coda, it misplaces them in a parody. The alternation of fast and slow can also generate results of a comical and highly theatrical kind, like two different characters who speak to one another or past one another. Variation 21 of Beethoven's Diabelli Variations, the utterances of the two characters, one coarsely energetic, the other whining, remain incompatible, and the unity of musical context is startlingly broken up. Before the end of Beethoven's G major sonata, Opus 31, number 1, there is a succession of different tempi, with adagios almost too slow and rests almost too long for comfort, only to be followed by a presto that tries to make up for the wasted 30 seconds by comic haste. Who has not succeeded in making somebody in his audience laugh at the end of this sonata should become an organist. One of the pieces that can only be appreciated in terms of the obsessively comical is the first movement of Beethoven's sonata, Opus 31, number 1. One looks at this piece from a purely formal perspective and without any psychological insight, one might dismiss it as incompetent, repetitious, and unworthy of Beethoven. But it would be naive to assume that Beethoven, in the course of this movement, brought in the same opening idea 7 times in the same G major and in an identical position without doing so on purpose. There are further clues to his comic intentions. The two hands that seem unable to play together, the short staccato, the somewhat bizarre regularity of brief spells of sound interrupted by rests. The character that emerges is one of compulsive but scatterbrained determination. The piece seems unable to get anywhere except where it should not go. What a nice surprise to find oneself for the second theme in the key of B major instead of the dominant, or in E major instead of the tonic. A surprise that, within a sonata form in a major key, must have been a novelty of an almost exotic flavor. The coda indicates to anybody who may have missed the point that nothing in this piece was meant to be taken at face value. As for the second movement, Adagio Grazioso, I shall first play a version of the theme that I have simplified to make it unfunny. And here is Beethoven's own version. I think of the two versions, Beethoven's original sounds like a parody of early Beethoven produced by Rossini, who, when this sonata was completed, was 10 years old. In Beethoven's Adagio, a complicated balance is achieved between sympathy and mockery, the graceful and the bizarre, nostalgia and anticipation, lyricism and irony. What is Beethoven being ironic about? His own style of the early rondos, the manner of coloratura, embellishment, the demeanor of a prima donna on stage, or the slightly grotesque suppleness of ballerinas like Taglioni or Fanny Elsler, indicated by the well-oiled mechanism of trills, staccato quavers, and musical periods. One might call this movement the first neoclassical piece of music. It is an irony in itself that Opus 31, number 1, seems to have been the only Beethoven sonata Stravinsky did not enjoy. The combination of incongruous elements is generally regarded as a distinguishing feature of wit. In another example of musical wit, Beethoven's F major finale from the sonata opus 10, number 2, the solemn technique of fugal writing is abused for burlesque purposes. Adolf Bernhard Marx likened the movement to a child that plucks an old man's beard. Of course, there is never a serious attempt to present a proper fugal exposition, and the listener is left wondering what the composer's intentions were. Wittily torn between counterpoint and homophony, sonata and rondo, bristling energy and musical laughter. Already Haydn had been commended by Griesinger for his ability to lure the listener into the highest degree of the comical by frivolous turns and twists of the seemingly serious. For C.P.E. Bach's contemporaries, elevated affections like magnanimity, majesty, splendor, rage, revenge, despair, devotion, delight, or virtuousness had to be suggested by certain devices of musical style. Haydn applied such devices to the lowest category of poetics, the comical. The mescolanza di tutti I generi, of which Salieri spoke in connection with Haydn's masses, is also evident in his comic music. The promotion of the comical in string quartet, sonata, and symphony is one of Haydn's great innovations. Carl Friedrich Zelter explains in a letter to his friend Goethe that Haydn's art had been criticized in earlier years because, as he says, it immediately made a burlesque of the deadly seriousness of his predecessors, G.S. Bach and C.P.E. Bach. Haydn certainly did not set out to parody C.P.E. Bach, whom he revered, in the way early opera comique had parodied some works of Lully. Rather, the listener was stimulated to take the comical more seriously and accept it as a part of one's own life. The term the elevated comical had been used and may have been coined to characterize Haydn's music, including even the adagios, during which, as the musical almanac of the year 1782 states, people actually and properly are supposed to weep. Beethoven's F major finale that I played before starts with what may be called a laughing theme. And the dominating impact of the movement remains that of laughter. Nobody seems to doubt that music can sigh, metaphorically speaking, but I have read denials that music can laugh. To some people, the noise of laughter is contagious. To the depressive, laughter may be painful and unavailable. To others, laughter is vulgar, seriousness, a sign of maturity, and everything that is hilarious, a desecration of loftier states of mind. To step down from one's elevated platform would mean to lose one's self-respect. The Austrian Emperor Joseph II disapproved of what he called Haydn's jests. Laughter poses a danger to state and religion. Plato wanted to ban it. Laughter is incompatible with the holy and the absolute. Or rather, it is the privilege of the deity, whether sardonic, as in Indian mythology and the Iliad, or serene, as in Hegel's unquenchable laughter of the gods. According to a Jewish joke, man thinks, God laughs. Umberto Eco, dealing with the significance of laughter in his novel The Name of the Rose, quotes Pliny the Younger. Aliquando preterea rideo, ioco ludo homo sum. Sometimes I laugh, I joke, I play. I am human. The laughter of man is not the laughter of gods. Anybody who has witnessed a little child recognizing a parent, relishing a new toy, or embarking on an exciting adventure knows that there is laughter that does not originate in catastrophe or represent superiority. There is superior laughter in Beethoven's Diabelli variations. In spite of its range of different emotions, serious and lyrical, mysterious and depressive, withdrawn and brilliantly extroverted, Beethoven's greatest independent set of variations reveals itself as a humorous work in the widest possible sense. It contains every variety of the comical. Schindler says, and for once I'm inclined to believe him, that the composition of this work amused Beethoven to a rare degree, that it was written in a rosy mood, and that it was bubbling with unusual humor, proving those wrong who thought that Beethoven spent his late years in complete gloom. According to Wilhelm von Lenz, an early commentator of particular insight, Beethoven in this work shines as the most deeply initiated high priest of humor. He calls the variations a satire on its theme. To me, already Diabelli's waltz is comical. I find it comical because both of its halves are so stubbornly alike, and because it seems to try to be something it is not. It is not a genuine waltz of any kind. The dynamic markings and the tempo indication vivace, it turns out to be an old-fashioned minuet. With these markings, on the other hand, the piece tries a bit too hard to sound like a modern bagatelle. Indeed, it has been argued by Konrad Wolf that all these un-Diabellian crescendos and sforzandos that go against the grain of the piece may have been an addition by Beethoven himself, which they evidently are not. They are the only feature of the theme that Beethoven in his variations disregards. To maintain the character of the theme in the first variation was one of the unwritten rules of classical variation practice. Beethoven scraps it and counters our expectations and the unreality of the waltz immediately with a march. Has a theme been dealt with more critically and with less regard for convention? Even its rhythmic structure is frequently ignored. No fewer than 10 variations shorten or augment its layout or change its proportions. Variation 22 parodies the theme with the help of Notte e giorno faticar, from the beginning of Mozart's Don Giovanni. Added to give Leporello the chance to find his way back into C major, whereas the German dance of Variation 25 feigns incompetence by losing the last bar of the first half. The final variation puts an end to the masquerade of the theme. It is now transformed into a veritable minuet and lifted to a sphere of angelic grace. In the German Musical Encyclopedia of 1875, I found an admirable article on humor, "The New Grove Has None." It sets humor apart from other modes of the comical in that it is a world view, a complete outlook on life. For the humorist, the article says, there are no fools, only foolishness and a mad world. This, again, is a formula borrowed from Jean-Paul. He will, therefore, perceive man and the world to be not ridiculous or revolting, but pitiable. Humor relates to the dark undercurrent of life and prevails over it. If we understand humor in this comprehensive sense, the Diabelli variations are one of its musical paradigms. You may have noticed that the name Mozart has hardly been mentioned. In looking for examples in his works, I found myself to be the victim of prejudice. I wrongly assumed that his absolute music should be a mine of the comical because his letters abound in hilarious wordplay and nonsense, and because the music of his operas makes such superlative use of all comical resources. Haydn and Beethoven, with all their love for cantabile, were predominantly instrumental composers. Sensual beauty of sound was not an innate quality nor a primary concern. The imagination of Mozart or Schubert, however, was predominantly vocal, even in their instrumental works, and the style of Mozart's symphonies had been castigated accordingly as too operatic by Nägeli. Singing, like sensuality, is hardly funny. It constitutes an area of beauty that opens itself to the comical only by means of words and comic acting. Singing itself can become comical where it turns into grotesque utterance. The music of our time has seized upon such sounds or noises suggestive of the absurd and the crudely physical. Mozart's beauty of cantabile is matched by the beauty of his musical proportion and balance, that singular illusion of complete formal perfection at any time. Next to Mozart's truly classical sense of order, Haydn often appears adventurous and whimsical. Where Mozart somehow manages to surprise us with what we expect, Haydn excels in the unexpected. Our B major chord or the sudden fortissimo chord in the Adagio of his Surprise Symphony are only a few of many obvious examples. For most performers and virtually all concert audiences of our time, music is an entirely serious business. Performers are meant to function as heroes, dictators, poets, seducers, magicians, or helpless vessels of inspiration. The projection of comic music needs a performer who dares to be less than awe-inspiring and does not take him or herself too seriously. Comic music can be ruined and made completely meaningless by serious performance. It is much more dependent on a performer's understanding than an allegro di bravura, a nocturne, or a funeral march. To manage to play a piece humorously is a special gift, yet I'm afraid it is not enough. The public, expecting the celebration of religious rites, may not notice that something amusing is going on unless it is visibly encouraged to be amused. I admit that to expect a player to radiate amusement while performing is a tall order. The trouble is that many performers, on account of their concentration and nervous tension, look unduly grave or grim, no matter what they play. The first bars of a classical piece set its mood. To sit down and start Haydn's last C major sonata with a tortured look is even worse than to embark on the so-called Moonlight Sonata with a happy smile. Nobody will mistake the first movement of the Moonlight for a cheerful piece, whereas the hilarious beginning of Haydn's C major sonata can easily sound wooden and pointless. Before the first note, a discreet signal has to pass from the performer to the audience. Caution, we are out for mischief. The notion of humor arrived in Germany, Lessing translated the word humor as Laune. Laune, according to Kant, means, in its best sense, the talent for being able voluntarily to put oneself into a certain mental disposition in which everything is judged quite differently from the ordinary method. Reverse, in fact. And yet, in accordance with certain rational principles in such a frame of mind. This sounds to me like an apt description of the quality a performer of comic music should be able to summon up. But this manner, as Kant further says, belongs rather to pleasant than to beautiful art, because the object of the latter must always show a certain dignity in itself. For my part, I am perfectly happy to enjoy the sublime in reverse and leave Kant's dignity behind, where Haydn and Beethoven took such obvious pleasure in doing so. Thank you very much.
I'm Sean Ferguson. I'm the dean of the Schulich School of Music, and we have a few minutes for questions from the audience, if you have any. So there are, I believe, a couple of people with microphones, but yes.
What do you think about Scarlatti? Has he humor in his sonatas?
I would think one can find the humorous, the grotesque. It's amazing how many things he can express while always keeping to a certain format. I'm a great admirer. But I think that what is humorous in his music can be expressed better on the harpsichord. I'm not usually so Catholic, but I like his music on the harpsichord.
Any other questions? Any other questions? I actually had a question, if you don't mind, just one very short question. In Bach, because people frequently think of Bach as being such a serious composer, but I think, for instance, the quadlibet at the end of the Goldberg Variations, or the sort of the false subject entries in a fugue where he thinks he's coming in one voice and then he actually comes in another voice. Is Bach a funny composer?
You can find some cheerful things, yes. Yeah. But not in the sense of the B major chord.
No.
But Bach can sometimes surprise you in his cantatas, yes. Because a woman sings, I'm nauseated, and the music sounds completely jolly. To us today.
Are there any other questions? I think, okay, then I'll welcome Rosie Goldstein back to the stage.
Thank you, Dean Ferguson and Dr. Brendel. Thank you for sharing your talent, your enormous wisdom, and I want to add particularly, especially, your sense of humor.
Thank you.
As you have done throughout your distinguished career, you reminded us today, you reminded your audience of the extraordinary nature of music. You demonstrated how the greatest works, some of them hundreds of years old, remain powerfully relevant today and able to inspire the whole range of emotions in us, the listeners. Once again, I want to thank you on behalf of the McGill community, your new community. Welcome. Thank you. And I have a small gift I'd like you to accept. On behalf of all of us.
Thank you.
Thank you to the audience. Have a great weekend.